Hello to all my fellow 101 History Podcast listeners out there. It certainly is good to be back on the air with you guys, and hard to believe today is the last day of October. October certainly has gone by very quick, to say the least, but one thing that I have really enjoyed seeing is the enhanced foliage where I live in Virginia. I live in central Virginia, that is, but it's really nice to have seen more so within the last week or week and a half to see the foliage really pick up. I've been elsewhere recently. I know a few weeks back my wife and I were in West Virginia, and the foliage was very magnificent there. In the Shenandoah Valley, it was good. But I would have to say between the two, West Virginia really shined the brightest. But where I live and what I'm seeing now, I'm seeing lots of yellow, orange, red, and some purple. But it's always nice to see the foliage when it's getting at the midway point and eventual peak point. It's not one of those things I take for granted, because it is nice to see the foliage. It's nice to see the bright colors. It's just that special time of year. Now, of course, would I give anything in the world to go up to New England or in the or say in the New York State's Adirondack Mountains to see foliage? Absolutely. I'd give anything in the world to go back up to Lake Placid and see the foliage all around the lake and just around the village itself. I mean, that to me is would be quite a visit, to say the least. Of course, my wife and I did get to go to Lake Placid 13 years ago, and that was a special trip. We got to see where history itself was made back in 1980 when a group of 20 amateur players, you know, the outsiders would have labeled them just as college kids, but others would have called them amateurs, defeated one of the best hockey teams in the world, being that of the Soviet Union. And, you know, it was dubbed Miracle on the Ice for all the right reasons. As a matter of fact, we got to go inside the arena where history unfolded. And our tour guide was part of the committee that helped persuade the International Olympic Committee to bring the games to Lake Placid come 1980. I think one of the most powerful stories from a historical standpoint, a day after the American kids defeated the Soviet Union, the parents were making their way into the mess hall, the parents of the players, the American players. The Soviet players all got up and applauded the parents. They applauded them for how their kids took on one of the greatest hockey teams and yet pulled off the biggest miracle there was, when many didn't even believe it was possible. Here the United States was in the midst of a hostage crisis, not knowing when 52 hostages would get released. And yet, here America was struggling to not only find its identity again in the world, but they needed something to feel good about. And yes, the hostage crisis still remained after the games at Lake Placid, but knowing that the United States took gold and defeated the Soviet Union, it made Americans feel good about something, that at least something was going right for them. So long story short, the kids, the parents of the 20 kids who made up the United States Olympic hockey team, they received a warm welcome from the Soviet players, only for their coach to tell them to sit back down. Well, the sad part is that when the Soviet players got back to Russia, they all lost a rank in the military because of the loss. It's one thing to lose, but there does come a price for losing. And many in the Soviet Union said to these players, who'd you lose to? You lost to some Americans? You lost to amateurs? What was the matter with you? As one Soviet player said, you know, it's one thing to win the silver medal, but it's not something that is it's not something that's highly regarded. But he went on to say that he did believe in miracles after after seeing the opposition pull off the upset. So the bottom line is that even in times of crisis, when someone or a country is looking for identity, something good can come out of the middle of the crisis. But anyways, I think it's fair to say that we should shift gears and get on with the necessary work that we've already been talking about, but continuing to go forward with it in this podcast series of Michael Schumacher's Torn in Two, The Sinking of the Daniel J. Morrell and One Man's Survival on the Open Sea. In this next segment, folks, we have a lot of ground to cover, but then again, there's always lots of ground to cover, which is never a bad thing. But in this next segment, we're going to ante up the game. In other words, we already know that Dennis Hale and three other crewmen by the last names of Stoichek, Fassbender, and Cleary, Art Stoichek, I should say, John Cleary, and Charles Fassbender. How about that? We are at the point where we know where there are four men on a life raft. We now will go forward in determining the chances of survival. I mean, we already know that as of right now that the chances of survival are not the strongest. But going forward in this episode, we're going to learn how the chances of survival fluctuate. We're going to learn about more about certain elements of nature and how brutal the situation already is, but how much more brutal it will become, because it's one thing to be stuck between a rock and a hard place. Yes, you want to cling on to hope that you will get rescued, but no matter how hard you want to believe that you will get rescued, you also have to wonder, what are the chances, or what is the percentage chance of my not being rescued? What is the percentage that that my wife and children will be notified by the Coast Guard that that their loved one won't be coming home at all? So many things are already playing out as it is, but here again, folks, the game is going to be anteed up. So tonight's podcast is the start of a two-part series in Torn in Two, The Sinking of the Daniel J. Morrell, where we will be discussing what's called Gauntlets of Hope and Despair. So here we go, folks, with our first lead-off question. Had Dennis Hale, Charles Fassbender, Art Stoichek, and John Cleary all endured the wrath of the waves even after making it onto the life raft? Do you all think that these four men endured the wrath of the waves even after making it onto a life raft? The answer is yes. I know on one hand that it would be easy to assume that when you're on a raft, that you would be automatically spared from any other unforeseen troubles that could lie ahead. I wish that were the case, but unfortunately, it's not going to be the case. For starters, the first wave came upon the life raft, get this, folks, between 25 to 30 feet in height. Can you imagine all of a sudden making it onto a life raft and a wave, and we're not just talking about some dinky little wave that you might find at the beach, but in this case, a wave that is that comes about because of all the other factors with the storm. And when these storms get bad, folks, the waves can intensify. If all the proper ingredients of a storm go about kicking into place, then the waves themselves will bring fury. They will bring fury that yes, some men have experienced before, but others haven't. And this is where survival or a test of survival sets in. So yes, the first wave came upon the life raft between 25 to 30 feet in height, which led to Dennis Hale himself holding on to a steel rod that ran from side to side on the raft. Okay, so folks, Dennis Hale is now, all four of these men have felt some impact with the first wave. They did endure some other waves, but it's one thing to get soaked with water, but the impact of these waves can also lead to other outcomes. You know, I'm surprised that none of these four men got thrown overboard, only for another wave to come right away and perhaps suck them underwater to where eventually they could have drowned because of how fast the waves were coming at them. So it really is a miracle that Dennis Hale was able to hold on to a steel rod that ran from side to side on the raft, because without that steel rod, he probably could have gone overboard. And who's to say that that any of the other three men whom are already struggling, who's to say that they might not have been able to have found another device or two that could have gotten Dennis Hale back to safety. You know, sometimes when one gets goes overboard, you know, sometimes you can, depending on the circumstances, you can throw out rope, and that can help a person tug onto something and eventually get lured back in. But when you are dealing with these intense elements where objects are coming left and right, such as, you know, monster-sized waves, you don't have that luxury. Luckily, the raft with all four passengers passed through the monster wave without nobody going overboard, despite all of them getting drenched to undergoing dyspnea, or a shortness of breath. I could see how all four of these men would have experienced more than one episodes of shortness of breath. Another measure of torture set in being gale force winds. Those gale force winds, folks, coming at 39 to 54 miles per hour or greater. These gale force winds, folks, they tore into all four men's clothing. In other words, the winds didn't rip apart the men's clothing, but the winds were so strong, folks, that it led to a burning sensation. I never would have thought that. I was actually blown away when I read this book that that these gale force winds produced burning sensation feelings. For Dennis Hale, it felt as though his skin endured peeling. No relief on sight. I can't imagine this feeling of as if skin was peeling off of me, even though it wasn't. But the winds, you know, say at least 70 miles an hour with rough seas. Yeah, it you know, think of it as like a million things coming at you at once. For Dennis Hale, he endured the loss of feeling in his legs. That's not a good sign, but to me, what a good sign was, and what he did, and what he was able to do, despite all the elements against him, is that he went as far as modifying circulation movement by stretching to moving legs and ankles, to placing his own hands in his mouth as a means of preventing cramping and freezing. Man, this guy, one would think that Dennis Hale has been out on the water for at least 10 years and that he must know all the ins and outs. You know, at this point in time, we all would like to think that maybe he has experienced something like this before. Who knows? But I have a good feeling that before this segment episode is over with, that we'll figure out exactly when he started, when he first began sailing on Great Lakes waters. But nonetheless, kudos to him in the midst of this storm that he has still been able to find the will to modify circulation movement via stretching to moving legs and ankles to placing hands in his mouth as a means of preventing frostbite. Prior to daybreak on November 29th, aka morning, when daylight first appears, or what's known as dawn, the storm itself let up, despite the never-ending gale force winds inflicting their wrath amongst the four men on the life raft. Okay, so I think most of us would probably want to know, whereabouts are these four men positioned on the life raft? They probably all can't be huddled next to one another, but let's find out. Dennis Hale was positioned on his left side in the raft's middle. John Cleary lied face down on his stomach to the right of Dennis Hale. Art Stoechek was curled up to the left of Hale. As for Charles Fassbender, he was positioned just below Hale. The early morning hours of November 29th brought more uncertainty. For Dennis Hale, he noticed that John Cleary appeared unresponsive. This doesn't sound good, folks. Dennis Hale tried jabbing him to basically see if he could get him to wake up. He tried this a couple of times, folks, but there was no luck. John Cleary sadly died in the middle of the night. Dennis Hale turned next to Art Stoechek. He tried waking him up. But sadly, Art Stoechek has now died himself. Folks, in a matter of a few short hours, from the time they were first thrown overboard, and all four of them being on a life raft, two men have died. Now Dennis Hale has to wonder, what about Charles Fassbender? There is good news to report, folks. Charles Fassbender did respond to Dennis Hale. That means, folks, that 50% of the men in the lifeboat are still alive. 50% seems good, but we have to wonder, will 50% remain if these two men are found alive? For both Dennis Hale and Charles Fassbender, they each remained as upbeat as possible about their chances of being discovered, or I should say found, to getting rescued. But at the same time, they each wondered if anyone by land was aware that the SS Daniel J. Morrell had been reported as missing. You really do have to wonder, in the midst of the storm, did a local Coast Guard station get informed about the SS Morrell going missing? Was there an all-points bulletin already out? Dennis Hale himself believed that he and Charles Fassbender would get rescued during the afternoon. Well, in times like these, you have to stay as upbeat as possible, even if you know that there are odds against you. Because if you stay negative the entire time, you're only hurting everyone around you who might be depending upon you not only for leadership, but for proper means of survival. Charles Fassbender was not in the best of shape. And what I mean by that, I'm not talking about like overweight, folks. Charles Fassbender endured a series of injuries that resulted when he got thrown off the Morrell's bow section. He injured his chest and shoulders. So when the wave came over the railing and struck the bow, not everybody went off the bow peacefully. So for Charles Fassbender, folks, he injured his chest and shoulders pretty badly. And he's in dire need of medical assistance. Okay, well, if you're in dire need of medical assistance right now, I mean, think about it. There's no such thing as a cell phone. I don't even know if there's a first aid kit on this life raft. The bottom line is that if Charles Fassbender doesn't get rescued along with Dennis Hale, Charles Fassbender might not make it, in large part, Not only because of the elements of nature, perhaps, but really because of how badly his chest and shoulders have been injured. The afternoon hours of November 29th, 12 hours after the SS Daniel J. Morrell broke apart, Charles Fassbender's state of well-being further declined. This is not good news for Dennis Hale. For Charles Fassbender, he went about enduring a rough, hacking cough. You know, it's easy when we cough, we try to do the 101 cough to the best of our abilities, but sometimes we're not able to do that. To me, a rough hacking cough in this case would be one that perhaps involved coughing up liquid water that you might have accidentally ingested after having been thrown off initially from the vessel as she was breaking apart. And two, the wrath of the wave as well that came over. And then with the excessive gale force winds, it's hard to keep your breath under control when all these things are coming at you. Think about it, folks. These men don't have scuba diving equipment. You know, when you go under water for scuba diving, you wear a mask, and you can breathe within this mask. But these men don't have that luxury. Dennis Hale observed the horizon, or I should say the nearby distance, for any signs of people performing search and rescue missions. That is, people aboard a vessel like a U.S. Coast Guard cutter or a helicopter. As time went along, Dennis Hale didn't see any of this in terms of not being able to spot anyone performing a search and rescue mission. He became convinced that nobody knew. I should say he became all the more convinced that nobody knew that the SS Daniel J. Morrell was in fact lost. Hale and Fassbender both clung on to hope with the belief that they would be reunited in time to spend the holidays surrounded by loved ones. At 2 p.m. November 29th, it's still daylight, but there's just under 3 hours left before sunset. What does that mean, folks? Another round of sub-freezing temperatures. Another evening, folks, of having to face more unknown circumstances, more unknown realities, sub-freezing temperatures. Here we go again. Are we going to make it through the second night? We already made it through the first night, but can we survive into the second night? To me, this is beyond unthinkable. Charles Fassbender, however, did spot land just before or right around 2 o'clock. How was he able to do this? Well, he had enough energy in him to be able to detect rocks and boulders per the shallow water that stood near the shoreline. I tell you, even when you might appear weak and under desperate circumstances, if you still have the energy to make out something that is not far along the horizon, then more power to you to be able to show some form of persistence. Hang tight for just a moment, folks. Here I am drinking a glass of water to stay hydrated. And you know, the sad part is for these men, given that they never thought they were in the circumstances that they would be in, they don't have any luxuries such as food and beverages. They can't drink a cup of hot chocolate. They can't drink a cup of hot coffee, hot tea, or even let alone a hot toddy. So you almost have to wonder, what could anyone do as a means of not only just staying hydrated, but reduce their chances of dying from exhaustion, dying from hypothermia. There's so many what-ifs and so many questions all within a short matter of time as to what can we do to modify our chances of survival. We've already done some things as it is, but there's so much more left to do. For Dennis Hale, he knows that Charles Fassbender is not in the state, not in a good state. He knows, I mean, he sees firsthand that Charles Fassbender is enduring a rough hacking cough. Dennis Hale doesn't just sit back, folks, and say, well, that's Charles Fassbender's problem, not mine. No, Dennis Hale knows that Charles Fassbender needs help. And, of course, Charles Fassbender knows that Dennis Hale himself needs help. They both know that they need help. But what does Dennis Hale persuade Charles Fassbender to do? He urges Fassbender to hack out whatever he could that had been stuffing up his lungs. Okay? There's nothing wrong with this. So, Charles Fassbender does what he can do. I don't know how to tell you all this, folks, but I will tell you this now. Despite Charles Fassbender's best efforts, it simply wasn't enough to overcome everything he had already endured. Charles Fassbender, folks, ultimately fell into Dennis Hale's hands. Folks, Charles Fassbender has now died. He has died right in front of Dennis Hale's eyes. We all need to put ourselves right now in Dennis Hale's shoes more than ever. Folks, Dennis Hale is now the only survivor aboard the life raft. Within a few short hours, folks, Dennis Hale was with three survivors. Yes, they all knew that they all had a goal in mind to be rescued. They all knew at the same time that there were chances that they might not all be rescued. They probably all knew that maybe two at best could survive out of the four. But now it's only one on this life raft, folks. For Dennis Hale, he's left to wonder how he could be expected to survive when his three mates died from elements leading to hypothermia. Dennis Hale was tired, hungry, thirsty, frostbitten, to suffering from exposure. Exposure, folks, hypothermia. Hypothermia is more than just numbness. It's a lot of other things. There are even different stages of hypothermia. I think that's something that we all would have a tendency to forget, but we should be reminded of. To me, it's terrifying, folks. I can't imagine being in this man's shoes. Well, did the life raft with Dennis Hale and three deceased crewmen make it to rest along the confines of shallow water? The good news, folks, here is that yes. Of course, the good news is that Dennis Hale did get to see this happen. The sad part is his other three crewmates didn't. Once coming ashore, Dennis Hale did spot rocks, trees, and a farmhouse structure. But the dilemma here, folks, is that Dennis Hale is in no shape to get out of the life raft. He just can't get out of the life raft and start walking and running to the nearest building, being this farmhouse structure, and go knocking on the door and saying, help me, I need help. My three crewmates are dead. I don't know where else to go, but I need help. Dennis Hale, folks, is not in this kind of condition. He is utterly weak. He was utterly weak in getting off the raft. He went as far as shouting out for help to the best of his ability. You know, there's no megaphone, folks. Even probably with a megaphone, I don't even know if anybody could get to him or where the call would be coming from. So, what do you know, folks? He did have another flare. A rocket flare, you could say. A distress flare. He managed to fire that last flare, but no signs of nearby help came about. You know, we do forget that even when we, when someone or a crew aboard a ship fires off a rocket distress signal, it may not automatically mean that a party nearby might recognize it or take even take the initiative to go to the scene. If there's one good example, not to get off track here, for those of you who were with me when we talked about the other side of the night, the Carpathia, the California and the night the Titanic went down. Remember that mystery ship being the California that was only about 10 miles away at best from the Titanic? And remember some of the California crewmen had notified their captain, being that of Captain Stanley Lord, that we see rocket distress signals. We need to check this out. What did Captain Lord say? You'll have to give me a better position than that. Well, so to sum it up, folks, that yes, you can fire a flare, but it doesn't always translate into someone being nearby in terms of a boat being nearby, or let alone a Coast Guard station being nearby to make out whether or not the object that was launched into the sky was in fact something that represented a matter of distress. Well, things aren't going to get any better as of right now, folks. How so? Well, the evening of November 29th, Dennis Hale's body weight, folks, dropped. We're not talking 5 pounds, folks. How about 25 pounds? Dennis Hale's weight, folks, dropped 25 pounds from the time he was first thrown off the SS Morrell. And all this has to do with all the elements that came at him. I mean, not just the waves. The waves aren't going to probably cause you to lose the weight. It's the hypothermia. It's the gale force. The gale force winds could have an impact. How about being exposed to elements that could result to frostbite, numbness, in and out, going in and out. So many variable factors. Shortness of breath. As time passed from evening to daylight come November 30th, Dennis Hale began further questioning his purpose for living, given 3 fellow crewmates lay dead around him, and survival itself an uphill battle with no end in sight. If I were in Dennis Hale's shoes, and I think it'd be fair to say if any of us were, by this point in time, I think it would be fair to say that we should probably be rightfully questioning our purpose for living. I know that sounds harsh to say. I'm not trying to be negative, but think about it. Why am I being spared when 3 other crewmates of mine around me are dead? Why did they die? I should have just died right with them. But why am I here? Well, I will give you a little brief background on Dennis Hale from his early years. I'm not going to get into a whole lot of it because what I read, it is powerful. It is sad. I know I did mention from a previous podcast about how he and one of the other crewmates who did die on the life raft, that the two of them did not have the best relationship with their fathers. Dennis Hale was born on January 23rd, 1940, in Cleveland, Ohio. His mother, Ruby Hale, sadly died from complications after she gave birth to Dennis. So sadly, folks, Dennis never got to meet his mother. I think that's a terrible void, to say the least. Dennis's father, his name was Clater Hale. His father ran an auto repair garage shop. Sadly, Mr. Hale struggled to raise Dennis and his 3 other siblings. Dennis had 2 brothers and a sister, so the children were sent to live with various relatives. However, over time, when Dennis was in his mid-teens, or by the time I should say he became a teenager, I should say, he did return back to Ohio, where his father was living, but the relationship never improved 100%. I don't know how I could best describe the percentage threshold of improvement, but it just never got to that 100% threshold. If there was one element he was lacking, and yet he sorely needed it, it was a sense of belonging to something. And you know, folks, we all need to belong to something. Something that can give us joy in life. Something that can give us a reason for living. Something that can help us develop talents that we never expected to acquire, and we have the means to go about passing them on to other people. So for Dennis Hale, his father did remarry, and it turns out that luckily Dennis Hale had a decent relationship with his stepmother. His stepmother taught Hale about her own personal faith through practicing it. She was a deeply religious woman. Her faith was that of Catholicism, which in the long run gave Dennis Hale strong comfort and meaning. Dennis Hale had another unique passion. He loved to cook. And he met his wife, Bertha, at a hotel restaurant in Ashtabula, Ohio. They had two children together, but Bertha had two children from another marriage. So with this growing family, Dennis Hale saw work on freighter ships as an advancement. So come 1964, folks, Dennis Hale joined the SS Daniel J. Morrell. Early on, I had said that one could say that he had probably been on the waters for some time. Well, he's only in his third year on the water, but this is the ultimate fight for survival, one that he never imagined would happen. But it's here in front of him. What had Bethlehem Steel, which was the company that owned the SS Daniel J. Morrell, what exactly had Bethlehem Steel done come around 12 p.m. November 30th, 1966? The company contacted the Coast Guard Rescue Coordination Center in Cleveland, Ohio, and reported the Daniel J. Morrell as missing. I want you to all pay careful attention to the number I'm about ready to reveal. 34. Why is the number 34 so important? It's the total number of hours which had passed since the time the Daniel J. Morrell itself had first come apart. 34 hours. November 29th, the day before, the first signs of concern were expressed regarding the Morrell's safety, given her captain was expected to radio his position report to the Bethlehem Steel facility in Cleveland, but it never happened. Now, what about the Edward Y. Townsend, whom was the Daniel J. Morrell's sister ship? Well, we all know that the Edward Y. Townsend sailed under similar conditions as the Morrell had done, but unlike the Morrell, the Townsend made it through despite dealing with Mother Nature's fury. Captain Thomas Connolly of the Townsend advised Art Dobson, chief dispatcher for Bethlehem Steel in Cleveland, that he last spoke to Captain Arthur Crawley at 12:15 a.m. November 29th. But he tried contacting Captain Crawley again an hour and a half later at 1:45 a.m., got no response. 2 hours later, he did the same thing again at 3:45 a.m. Both times when he tried contacting at 1:45 and at 3:45 a.m., the only sound he got was that of a staticky noise. Well, folks, when the ship splits in two, you're going to lose all means of communication. Radio communication. I mean, that's what happened with Titanic. When she split in two, I mean, right as she was getting ready to sink, wireless operators were sending out whatever they could in terms of last minute Marconi wireless operators were sending out their last minute warning, last minute pleas for help. And I want to say the last one that was sent at around 2:17 a.m. on April 15th of 1912. The last SOS, save our ship. And by that time, you know, she splits in half, and all communication is pretty much gone. So yes, Edward Y. Townsend would have gotten was nothing but pure static noises or sounds. The morning of November 30th, Edward Y. Townsend did reach the St. Mary's River in Lime Island Fuel Station. And while in the midst of refueling, Captain Connolly noticed something very odd on his ship. He noticed a crack on board the spar deck that resulted in his notifying Art Dobson that he would have no other choice but to dock his vessel until further notice. Smart decision. Yes, I know that Captain Connolly would have given anything in the world to have gone out there and assisted with a rescue mission, but do you really want to take the risk? Do you really want to put Bethlehem Steel in another odd situation where they don't know just yet that they have lost, that they're going to lose a vessel, but to me, I think it would be bad enough if they lost two vessels in a short time span. So, yes, the Edward Y. Townsend, per Captain Connolly's order, it will be to dock the vessel until further notice. No one from Bethlehem Steel, including captains of other freighters, got through to the SS Daniel J. Morrell. I think it's fair to say now that all of them are beginning to believe now that the worst has unraveled, and that the SS Daniel J. Morrell not only is missing, but there is a good likelihood that she could have sunk in this terrible storm. 12:15 p.m. on November 30th, at that time that the Daniel J. Morrell was finally reported as officially missing, search teams from freighters, Coast Guard cutters to helicopters all went out in search of the Morrell. One freighter, being that of the CG Post, was moving 8 miles north of Harbor Beach Breakwater Lighthouse. One of her crewmen spotted something very unusual. He spotted a body facing downward in the water. Wow. I can't imagine being that crewman and spotting. It's probably not the first time that maybe this crewman has spotted a body. But knowing the circumstances that are at stake, one has to believe, okay, if this is a person, which it is this person alive or dead? One way or another, it's going to impact us all. Did the body spotted by a CG Post crewman have anything unique about it? It turned out that the human body floating face down in the water, folks, had an orange life jacket with the name SS Daniel J. Morrell inscripted on it. This person was none other than Dennis Hale, folks. Now, before we expand further with finding Dennis Hale, Dennis Hale, folks, right before the CG Post crewman recognized a person floating in the water, Dennis Hale has now already endured a higher level of hypothermia. This level goes beyond 101. This level of hypothermia saw Dennis Hale drifting in and out of consciousness, which included instances of sleeping, dozing off, to periodically hallucinating. What I mean by hallucinating here, folks, is that he's not sure if what he saw was actually real or fake. He heard sounds. And when he first heard the sounds, this to him included being under the assumption of hearing helicopters or airplanes flying above in search of him. However, in the end, the sounds were those of birds flying over. Birds, in this case, being seagulls. They were probably making gawking sounds as a means of communicating toward one another. I don't know, I'm just, that's just my guess, because usually when I see seagulls up close or see them on television, you know, if there's a nature documentary, you often hear them gawking. Prior to CG post freighter vessel spotting the body positioned downward, Dennis Hale had modified his means of survival once again by taking a piece from the broken flare gun. To me, what I'm going to tell you all folks here is pure ingenuity in the utmost time of despair. Dennis Hale took a piece from a broken flare gun where he used it as a cup by filling it with lake water. He drank the water in intervals. Okay? Yes, you know, you're thirsty. But if you drink all the liquid at once, it might do the exact opposite to you. Dennis Hale drank the water in intervals as a measure for not jeopardizing his body temperature. He probably already knows deep down that his body temperature is out of whack, but if he just gulps down water left and right, he's probably going to jeopardize his body temperature even further to where he could maybe go into shock and succumb altogether. And Dennis Hale also went as far, folks, as removing ice from his pea coat. By removing the ice from his pea coat, folks, he went about eating the ice for improving his chances of survival. You know, ice melts into water. You know, ice starts out as solid, but it melts into liquid water. You know, desperate times do call for desperate measures. In this case, desperate times also call for some unique ways of modifying your circumstances under the most, even if they are under the most unforeseen matters, even if they are beyond the most unimaginative of circumstances. Well, folks, is Dennis Hale going to be rescued? I'm sure some of you are now beginning to wonder, how much longer can this man cling on for survival? What happened around 4 p.m. November 30th, 1966, that can be best described as miraculous? For one, the noise Dennis Hale heard stood out as being different, given sounds were louder compared to what seagulls generally made. But secondly, an object with blades began to descend downward upon the raft, or I should say the life raft, where Dennis Hale was clinging on to, which he had done so for almost an eternity. The helicopter landed on the water nearby the raft. Two Coast Guard rescue crewmen, assisted Hale off the raft, despite the fact that he was very feeble and weak. You know, when we assist someone in getting up, usually they've fallen down, but yet they're not completely feeble or weak. But if you're able to just, you know, grab them up, you know, they're fine. But this was not a situation where Dennis Hale could just say, let me just get up on my own, I'll make my way on down, and we'll all go together. No, That's just not how it was. When you consider everything that he had been through, it's one thing to have rescued a survivor, but if I were the Coast Guard crewman, I can't imagine this one. Did the Coast Guard rescue crewman find recovery of Dennis Hale's deceased mates aboard the raft to be very intense? Yes. All three deceased crewmen on board the life raft were covered in ice, which included icicles hanging from their ears and noses. Al Massey, who was a Coast Guard rescue man, described the deceased sailors as follows in quotations, folks. Listen carefully. The bodies were frozen like statues. The way I interpret it is the following. The ice itself so solid to where it preserved the men in the positions they had stood in as they took their final breaths before perishing. No matter how hard one tried nudging, the ice was completely thick to where the bodies remained frozen intact. So the Coast Guard rescue crew worked tirelessly to remove the dead from the raft, where they walked each of them across the water and into the helicopter. Knowing the vehicle itself had limited space in the cabin, the deceased crewmen were taken by helicopter to Harbor Beach. I can't imagine, as much as we always want to believe when we perform a search and rescue that regardless of how many people are missing, we always want to believe that the Coast Guard will bring everybody to safety. You know, let's say you've got five people missing. Yes, you want to bring all five home. Okay, if you couldn't bring all five home, you would hope that you at least brought three home. Well, in this case, folks, the Coast Guard was only able to bring home one person out of the four. So I can't imagine having to transport these other three deceased crewmen. They got them all into the helicopter with limited space in the cabin. You know, I can only imagine how many, if there had been more men on this raft, I don't know how they could have made it work with, say, putting more than, if there had been other deceased crewmen on this life raft. You just wonder how much more room could the helicopter itself have held. Well, I will say this, that the discovery of one survivor did lift the spirits of those whom took part in the search and rescue mission. You know, even under the most dire of circumstances, rescuing one person is always better than none. But yet at the same time, as a U.S. Coast Guard rescue person who performs rescue operations, you do have to be prepared for just about anything, but you also have to be prepared to accept the fact that, number one, you always need to go out there with your best A game, but also know that even if you're not able to rescue everyone, at least know that, okay, if I rescued three out of five people, at least I know that I still did my job and didn't leave anything on the table. But I can only imagine how, for these Coast Guard crewmen, what the feeling was like knowing that for the man who survived, knowing that three of his crewmates didn't. And I think it's fair to say that the Coast Guard would have known that for the survivor, that he did everything there was to help his fellow crewmates before they succumbed to the elements of nature, with the intensity of the storm onto itself. So, yes, the discovery of one survivor did lift the spirits of those whom took part in this search and rescue mission. The ambulance did meet the helicopter, which went about transporting Dennis Hale to the hospital. William Hall, who was a Coast Guardsman whom was on scene, he saw Dennis Hale's condition up close. He did make an observation and even remarked, and this is not in quotes, but I did, I paraphrased it and summed it up per the best of my abilities. for William Hall, he firmly did believe that had Dennis Hale worn pants, not only would it have resulted in the pants getting saturated with water, but also it would have led to his becoming totally frozen, thus further impacting his overall body temperature state, which would have eventually led to death had help not arrived. So yes, it's one thing to wear pants, folks, but even wearing pants alone cannot assure survival. But of course, when you don't have a whole lot of time to work with, you probably don't have any other choice but to throw on what you have in front of you. That's just sadly the way it is sometimes under many of unforeseeable circumstances, especially in the month of November when nothing is ever certain and when the skies are always turning gloomy along the Great Lakes. Our final question for this segment episode is the following. Had word of Dennis Hale's survival moved quickly? Believe it or not, folks, it had. And of course, you know, the means of accessing news in 1966 is not what it is, obviously, today. But word of Hale's survival did move quickly. The media, or I should say news reporters, were very anxious to obtain information about the Morrell sinking, including Dennis Hale's rescue. However, thank heavens that there were people on staff that, you know, looked after Dennis Hale and wanted what was best for him. Ruth Wintonhalter was the hospital director. She kept reporters away simply on the grounds that Dennis Hale himself did not want to speak to the media. He also had not spoken yet to his wife. The Coast Guard is still conducting a search and rescue mission at this time with the hope that they will find other survivors. Dennis Hale was also thinking about his crewmates on board the raft whom died. And I don't blame him, because he probably would never have been able to have forgotten about them. He's also probably thinking about the other crewmates, including Captain Arthur Crawley, wondering, did any of them survive? And if they did survive, what are their chances of survival? Will they be just as good, or will they be just as miraculous as what I was able to be spared with? And why would Dennis Hale want to talk to the media? He's been through hell. If any of us had gone through what he had been through, we would say the same thing too. At the same time, you know, it's not about, you know, yes, some people could say, oh, it's just about Dennis Hale. No, it's not. Dennis Hale knows that there are three other men who've died, but he also knows that there are 25 other men out there whose lives have not been accounted for just yet, and that we should all still be clinging on to some hope that there might be some men whom could be found. Well, we've covered a lot of ground in this podcast segment episode to Torn in Two, The Sinking of the Daniel J. Morrell and One Man's Survival on the Open Sea. When I'm on the air again next, we will pick up with part two of Gauntlets of Hope and Despair, and we'll learn more about the other freighter vessels that went out on the waters to try to find other missing crewmen aboard the Morrell. And I will assure you that that was very powerful based upon when I read this book in terms of their efforts to find other missing crewmen. But what we do know is that one man has survived. Even though, yes, the book may say one man's survival on the open sea, but we still have to wonder, when will Dennis Hale exactly find out the opposite? I mean, when will he fully realize that, hey, did I in fact become the only person to survive? Well, we'll find out next time when I'm on the air again next. Take care for now, and wherever you all may live, continue to stay safe.